Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the third annual Oregon Queer Youth Conference. The conference is open to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, transsexual, queer, questioning, and intersex youth and their allies under the age of 23 to get together, discuss the issues, and have a crazy cool time. The conference takes place at the Caitlin Gable School, located at 8825 Southwest Barnes Road, on Saturday, February 25th, from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information, go to www.oqyc.org.
Portland International Film Festival is on again, and as usual, there are way too many films to choose from. But don't worry, KBOO is here to help. On Tuesday morning, we'll present a program of reviews of films in the festival. That's 9:30 Tuesday morning for the Portland International Film Festival.
Good evening. This is KBOO 90.7 FM. You're listening to Bread and Roses, our weekly women's news and public affairs program. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from, in other words, Women's Books and Resources, serving you from its new location at 8 Northeast Killingswood at Williams. In other words, it's your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, gifts, tools for the revolution, women's writings, and much more. 503-232-6003, or in other words, .org. And in other words, is hosting an event on February 15th. In other words, is hosting Loretta Ross, feminist leader and visionary, who is reading and signing her book at the new location of, in other words, on February 15th at 4 p.m. and the new location is at 8 Northeast Killingswood. This reading is followed by a lecture the same day, February 15, at 6 p.m. at the Women's Resource Center at Portland State University. And Loretta Ross is the co-founder and director of Sister Song, Women of Color Reproductive Health Collective, and the co-author of Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organized for Reproductive Justice. If you are a faithful reader of the KBO calendar, you may know that I promised you a report back tonight from the World Social Forum in Caracas, Venezuela, and a short overview of the situation of women in Venezuela. This we hopefully will do in the second half of the show at about 6:30. But because I have noticed, as I'm sure many of you have, that some of the rhetoric currently happening towards Iran is very familiar when you remember a few years back of thinking of the rhetoric that happens toward Iraq. First it was supporting terrorism, then it became weapons of mass destruction, then it became nukes, and I'm pretty sure pretty soon our human rights champions in our government in the United States will start talking about the oppressed women of Iran. So to kind of address that issue, I want to replay an interview I did a while back, having local Iranian women talk for themselves about their assessment of the current situation of women in Iran. So we do this for about 30 minutes, and then we switch to Venezuela. And welcome to Bread and Roses on KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to the panel discussion about women's issues in Iran. What we would like to do, considering our very limited time this morning, talking about such an interesting issue, is to be able to send you home with a new insight into the Iranian woman, one that's different from what has been portrayed in the U.S. media, and one that is much unlike what some U.S. politicians have referred to as from a culture of hostage takers, barbaric people, terrorists, and most recently, the axis of evil. Represented in the panel today is Marjan Daradar from Portland, Niloufar Nouri, an ex-Portlander now from the Bay Area, and myself, Arezou Movahed, also from Portland. As you can see, we are all Iranian women. I will start the talk myself and would introduce my other co-presenters as we get to their presentations. Like I said, my name is Arezou Movahed. I'm a faculty at the Institute on Aging at Portland State University, and I also direct the Senior Adult Learning Center at PSU. I have a doctorate degree in environmental psychology, and my research interests lie in the fields of aging and gerontology, environment and behavior, and built space evaluation. I'm fluent in Persian, in English, and in French. I frequently travel to Iran at least once a year, and here in Portland, I'm involved with several cultural Iranian organizations. I also collaborate with the PSU Middle East Studies Center on some projects, and also volunteer the rest of my professional time with a refugee resettlement program. I moved to the United States in 1977, moved to Portland, Oregon in 1984 with my husband, and now have a 3-year-old son. The three of us will try to each take only 7 minutes to make our presentation. That's a very hard task. So in order to get all that we want to get done in our 40 minutes or less, allow me to begin my formal presentation, and I'm just going to stick to my notes in order not to overextend my time. Iran, as in many other Muslim countries of the Middle East, is a patriarchal society with strong norms of female dominance. However, the issue of what's the proper role for women in society has been a very important issue in Iran and one of a lot of debate. Should women be constrained from public life and spend their energy staying at the home, keeping the house and raising children and taking care of the men's needs, as the traditionalists who are now in power would want? Or should women be encouraged to participate fully in all areas of public life as equal to men? The Iranian Islamic Revolution in 1979 fundamentally changed the role of women in society by enacting strict rules of conduct for women, including the dress code, education, and occupation choice. The revolution also simply returned gender roles in Iran to a previous period and reinforced traditional roles that were already in place in some parts of the country. So I would urge all of you to remember the dichotomy that exists in Iran today. In the same country, in the same culture, we are talking about whether they're a traditionalist person versus a non-traditionalist person, whether it's a practicing religious family versus a non-practicing religious family, whether it's the urban society versus the rural community, and whether it's the upper versus the middle versus the lower classes of society, all of which exist in Iran and all of which have their own certain codes of plea about women. So in my talk today, because of time limitations, I'm only going to be making reference to some of these differences. In the 1970s, just prior to the Islamic Revolution, the roles of women in Iranian society was changing from the older, more traditional way. Women had made progress, especially in the educated middle and upper classes. The government of the Shah and of his father just prior to him was promoting the rights of middle and upper class women. More women were being educated, getting their college degrees, including their doctorate degrees in a variety of fields that had traditionally been male fields of education. Educational opportunities were increasingly made available for women. Women entered academic areas, and many women intellectuals joined the ranks of faculty of universities. More women were active in public life and also held high government positions during that regime. Women at that time were also active participants in the 1979 Islamic Revolution, because many had realized that even though the educational and economic opportunities for some women had been improved, they realized that there hasn't been much improvement for the rest of women. Actually, some situations had actually worsened. And none of the educational and economic improvements had actually led to any political participation. Lots of women took part in marches and demonstrations that brought down the government of the Shah, and it wasn't until a few years later that women realized that the new Islamic government is dominated by traditional clergy who want to see traditional Islamic codes of conduct. It is unfair, though, to conclude that the situation of women in the new Islamic Iran has deteriorated. There has been a number of steps taken to promote women's issues, including literacy, education, and health. The biggest gain has actually been in the field of education. The participation of girls in primary and secondary education, even in the very remote areas of the country, has increased. In 1993, 47% of children in primary schools were females. At the university level, women students are now equal or higher in number than their male counterparts in some fields, and 48% of medical students are women. In fact, passing the very difficult college entrance examination in Iran, about 70% of the women who take the exam do get into the university, and out of the men, only about 45% are accepted. And there's different reasons for that. There is encouragement of the college-educated specialist woman to assume managerial and executive positions, and vocational training is also in some cases provided by the government to the economically deprived woman. In the past, the government pretended as if Iran had universal education, and even though government spending was quite high in the field of education, what was happening was that girls in some rural areas were often dropped out after the age of 9 or 10 or after the age of puberty because either the teacher was a male or the parents thought that mixed gender classes was not appropriate for their daughters. Looking at current numbers, the Islamic system has done a magnificent job in enrolling girls in schools, but the same problems still remain for retention and completion. New female teachers and girl-only schools or classes are in place in some very remote areas. But the problem today is that the parents are in economic hardship, and in spite of the free elementary education that's offered by the government, the family cannot afford to pay for all the extra expenses of sending their girls to school, such as paying for school clothes, buying books, and other things. So the United Nations Children Education Fund, with the collaboration of the Iranian government, is now involved in some projects on the education of girls in Iran. The Iranian Literacy Movement, or the Nehzat Savad Amuzi, is offering classes for the dropouts and those who had never enrolled. Enrollment in these classes is restricted to a certain number of girls under the age of 18, and then beyond that, there's room for mothers and other women over the age of 18 to also join the class. So in one situation, you may see a multi-generational class with grandmothers, mothers, and daughters in the same class. Just recently, UNICEF also began a community-based education project in the province of Sistan and Baluchistan. Now, mind you, this is the most deprived and marginalized province in the Islamic Republic of Iran. The province borders with Afghanistan and Pakistan and is home to many ethnic groups, including some Afghan refugees and very remote low-population village communities and nomadic tribes. Cultural attitudes of the area and severe traditional protocols impose many restrictions on women, and despite high government spending and heavy advocacy and continuous provisions by the Iranian Ministry of Education for the education of girls in this province, girls do not automatically access schools in these communities, and there's low enrollment levels. Research on the hindering factors on the enrollment and education of such girls shows that despite economic hardships, both parents and girls believe that if the content of the education was suited to their future needs, education would be considered a priority. For this reason, there is many projects in cooperation with the Literacy Movement Organization and the Ministry of Education in Iran to offer strategies and activities that would increase enrollment as well as retention. These projects have shown the highest retention rates, and strategies have clarified it further that if interventions are mounted with adequate understanding of the social and cultural norms of these rural areas and the remote villages, projects will be counterproductive for both the girls and their families. Outcomes also show a significant level of confidence and self-esteem among girls to voice their opinion, to have no fear of presenting their views and comfortably speaking in front of their fathers and the male officers who are there from the main centers or the bigger cities. So with this, I will turn the presentation to my co-presenter, Marjan Baradar. She's going to be talking about the psychological aspects of women. She is a licensed professional counselor and a nationally certified counselor in the state of Oregon. Marjan and her husband have three children and have been in the United States for 23 years. She received her bachelor's degree from Eastern Washington University in applied psychology and also got a master's degree in counseling and guidance from Oregon State in 1984. She enjoys working with couples, families, adolescents, and children to help facilitate a healthier and happier lifestyle in such a stressful time. She is currently having her private practice in Beaverton, Oregon, and conducts group therapy. So, Marjan, would you please?
I knew it's a rush society. I didn't know it's a rush speech. Before, thank you very much for the introduction, and I'm very pleased to be here and to say that two of my colleagues are also here, and I appreciate your participation. Because of the matter of time, I'm also going to read through my notes, so we'll be on time. The focus of my discussion today is psychological and social aspect of women in Iran. When I think about the women, the past, I'm thinking about our mothers, our grandmothers, great-grandmothers. The present time reminds me of us, the generation we are living in, and the future is our children, which are the byproduct of the present. In the past, the focus for the women was the family. There were only limited number of women driving and or having careers. A lot of women in the past had domestic goddess positions, and they respected that. Arranged marriages were customary, and it set the stage for unhappy marriages. It was customary to get married at ages 16 or 17 to an older man, to raise a family at early age, support her husband and his family, take care of the problems, solve the issues and concerns in the family as best as she could with her love, caring, dedication, and diplomacy. With limited or no education, for the bigger price of having the family, having a healthy family. Women didn't need to prove how good they were in the past. They were just loved and accepted as they were. Most women's worlds were limited and dominated by male authority figures. Women had better and more tolerance about problems in the family in the past. Families and women were happy with what they had. They accepted what they had, and there was no expectation of having more. Women had better tolerance about problems in the family. Most women in the past put up with issues of alcoholism, domestic violence, and abuse. codependency was encouraged. As much as women solved problems for youngers in their family, they wanted the problems to continue because that was part of their identity. Women's opinion and voices were not important in the society. Psyche was not important to women. There were a lot of psychosomatic problems that appeared in physical symptoms: depression, phobia, anxiety attacks, obsessive compulsive behaviors were all ignored or dealt with very lightly. Mental health issues were a taboo to talk about or even think about, until it got worse and it showed in either severe cases or physical symptoms like ulcers, migraine headaches and strokes, and so on, so forth. Iranian women in the past looked happy and calm, like an ocean, in the outside, and in the inside they were frustrated and angry. Iranian women's identity were her family, the children, the growth and success and failure of them all reflected back on her. Today's Iranian women in Iran are much more educated. Higher education is a priority for most women in Iran and in America. Almost 40% of the population in Iran, women have outside careers and still raise their children and have respect for their husbands. The focus of life for today's women is definitely changing. Because of different roles they have, the image of self has more importance than giving up of me and my needs for keeping the family together. Divorce rates have increased. Today, Iranian women have different pressures in Iran or in America for raising a family. Parental roles, careers, divorce, single mothering, no family or relative support, childcare, having enough income, challenges of success, and competition of employment. Today's women have to prove themselves with who they are and what they want in the society and at home. Women have voices, and expression of self is very much emphasized. Having a position in the family and society other than being a mom is very important. Women have learned to express their feelings and value system, sometimes more aggressive than assertive. And that's the anger inside. Most women have learned to stand up for themselves and take action for their safety and their rights. Today's women don't tolerate injustice. They don't want history to repeat. Independence is more exercised and encouraged. Women have more understanding about psyche, depression, anxiety attacks, phobia, codependency, and adjustment disorders. Still have a hard time to ask for help, but they don't ignore it or make a light of the problems. The new trend of today's women is, I want more. The more, the better. Couples decide to meet and then get married. Sometimes they wait a year before the marriage to get to know each other. Iranian women in general are very strong, persistent, competitive, and success is very important to them. We have more women doctors, dentists, lawyers, and professional women working in the parliament than ever in the history of Iran with the hijab. New statistics in Iran shows that more female students pass the college entrance exam than male students. I believe education will continue to have its importance in the future, and our children will have a more clear identity with their careers, their children, and their families. Everyone in the family will be valued and respected in the future. A better balance between the past and the present, with needs of wanting more or not wanting at all. Self will have its importance in the future, will have more power, and will be more nurtured. Hopefully, the women of tomorrow will have calculated decisions about their marriages, careers, and relationships. Women of tomorrow will give more attention to their psyche, and they will ask for help with the use of therapy and counseling. They will have a better sense of self in the society and at home. Thank you.
Thank you for staying. Our next presenter, Niloufar Nouri, is presenting a brief history of women's movement in Iran. She is the co-founder and executive director of BayVoter.org, a non-profit, non-partisan organization dedicated to educating and facilitating the active participation of Iranian Americans in the American civic life. She moved to the U.S. in 1985 and holds a master's degree in international affairs with a background in sociology and anthropology. She has had extensive experience in the nonprofit field, including co-founding two organizations working with Iranian American women, immigrants, and refugees. Her other interests include flamenco dance and playing the sitar. Since 1999, she has made the Bay Area her home and lives there with her husband and son.
Thank you, Arezu. Good morning, everyone. I would also like to thank the organizers of this workshop, especially Jean Campbell, for asking us to come here, and thank you all for being here. I'm going to talk about the women's movement in Iran, and of course a thorough analysis is very complicated and requires much more time than my 7 minutes. I just want to provide you with some basic information to give you an idea of what's been happening during this time. And I hope to give you an image of the Iranian woman that's very different from the one portrayed on CNN or the media that is usually covered up, passive, domestic, and silent. I hope you leave here today with the image of the typical Iranian woman who is one who has participated in every political, economic, social, and cultural challenge of the contemporary age and has been present in the labor market for 100 years. The beginning of the 20th century was a time of ideological and structural change in Iran. There was a great deal of public unrest that eventually culminated in the Constitutional Revolution of 1906, where the ruling Qajar dynasty was replaced by a republican liberal constitutionalism. During this revolution, women were involved in things like boycotting foreign goods or helping fundraise to establish the first national bank. They were not demanding freedoms and rights for women themselves, but for the general population, and they were active in demonstrations alongside with the men. It was after the revolution, when they realized they didn't gain anything as women, that they began to organize and demand rights. They made education their first priority and began to establish girls' schools. By 1913, there were 9 women's societies and 63 girls' schools in Tehran. Of course, from the beginning, they were being harassed by the more religious and traditional sector. Many schools were burnt down or closed, but the women prevailed and reopened the schools. And by the 1920s, there were women's magazines discussing rights, education, and emancipation. In 1927, Reza Shah was crowned and began a campaign to modernize and westernize Iran. Aside from building roads and developing the country's infrastructure, he also wanted to modernize the image of the country. And as part of this, all men except the clergy were ordered to dress like Europeans who were working in the government institutions, and all women were barred from wearing the chador, which is the black cover, and the scarf in public. This may seem as an advancement at first, but when you think about the reasoning and the devastating effect it had on many women, it really was no different than what the Islamic Republic did later on by ordering women to cover up. In both cases, women were denied a choice. In this case, women like my grandmother, her mother, her sisters, and their friends, and many women who were religious, could not bear to appear in public bareheaded, and so they remained behind the private walls of their homes. But during this time, women did gain some rights, including the right to ask for divorce under certain conditions, and marriage age was raised to 15 for girls, and there was a campaign for equal education for boys and girls. When Mohammad Reza Shah, whom you know as the Shah, came to power, he continued with his father's modernization programs. Women were given the right to vote and to be elected in 1962, and by 1978, 33% of university students were women. There were 22 women in the Majlis or parliament and 2 in the Senate. Polygamy was limited and required first wife's written consent. Marriage age was raised to 18 for girls. Women gained the right of guardianship for their children after their husband's death. In spite of all these improvements in the legal situation of women, there were many women from the more traditional and lower classes who were alienated and really did not benefit from these reforms. And they were among the ones who rose in opposition to the Shah. During the revolution of 1979, women participated in every aspect of the movement, from underground opposition groups to street demonstrations. In fact, I was 8 years old at the time and remember going to many demonstrations with my mother, and I can honestly say those were some of the best times of my life. Everyone was united for one cause, to rid the country of the Shah. Unfortunately, when the Islamic Republic was established, women suffered so many setbacks. A few examples are that women were ordered to observe the Islamic dress code, they were barred from becoming judges, the family protection law was abolished, Sharia, which is religious law, became legal code, and marriage age was reduced to 13 for girls, and schools were segregated. Women took to the streets and demonstrated against these setbacks, but they were brutally silenced. One of the slogans used in these demonstrations was "Dar tulu'e azadi jaye haqq zan khali," in the dawn of freedom, where are women's rights? During the 1980s, women were organizing, fighting back, and demanding reforms. One point of interest is that the segregation of sexes actually allowed millions of lower-class girls from traditional families and rural areas into the public life and the education system. It also required training of women to serve women. For example, there were thousands and thousands of women who were trained as gynecologists. And because of the physical dress of women that had conformed to Islamic laws, they had access to most anywhere and were able to participate in any debates. In the 1990s, the emergence of Muslim feminism in Iran happened. Zanon magazine, Zanon means women, and I have some copies to show you later on, was published in 1992 and, among other things, criticized the legal code and argued that gender equality was Islamic, but religious literature is misread and misappropriated by males. Books were published about feminist issues, including radical feminist books and biographies. A prenuptial document was drawn up to give women the rights they lacked in the religious law, where future husband forfeited his rights to polygamy and unconditional divorce. Women could initiate divorce, divide assets, and have joint custody of children and child support. It should be noted, however, that this is a voluntary contract. Men do not have to sign it, and if they don't, there are no legal consequences. In 1997, women played a decisive role in the presidential elections, and in 1998, 52% of students entering universities were women, and the fifth majlis, the parliament, had 13 female deputies out of 270. The laws that have passed in the last 10 years have helped reduce the harshness of laws against women, but they are still within the limits of conservative mentality. For example, women can now become judges and work in the judiciary branch, but they can only rise to the level of advising, not ruling judges. The legal system is traditional, but the economic, social, and cultural attributes of Iranian society are constantly changing. And there's a paradox in the life of Iranian women. Since the revolution, they've gained greater influence and power, and religious leaders have legitimized female participation in social and political processes. But because of attitudes and laws based on gender discrimination, women have continued to be treated as second-class citizens. And up to now, it's been women and only women who have worked hard to get where they are today, and they will fight until they have the freedom that they deserve. In the past several years, thousands of women rose to executive positions. Women have been appointed as president's advisors, as advisors to ministers, as directors general or deputy directors. One woman has been appointed vice president and another as the deputy minister of guidance and Islamic culture. But still, there is a long way to go before there is a proportionately satisfactory number of women in top executive positions to reflect the number and level of knowledge and expertise of women in society. And the struggle continues. Thank you very much.
One blood only. says Lillian Downs. This is still KBOO 90.7 FM, Bread and Roses, and you heard from Niloufar, Marjan, and Arezou talking about the contemporary situation of Iranian women. So now I want to switch geographics and go to Venezuela, and I'm very excited that Elizabeth Atlee, who is no stranger to KBOO, made it to the studio. Even though she's sick, she just came back from Venezuela last night, and her car got towed right before she came. So, welcome back.
Thank you, Gabby. Yeah, it's. I'm not sure how clear I can be tonight after all of that, but I had to take a taxi over because I couldn't find my car. So
that's devotion. That's devotion, I would say.
Yeah, really.
And I understood you hung out with KBOO's Patrick Engstrom.
Yes.
In mostly Caracas.
Mostly Caracas, and we went to Merida. There were several of us, Barbara Bernstein also from KBOO, and several from Portland.
Mm-hmm. And what were your impressions of the World Social Forum?
It was thrilling to be there amongst people from all over the hemisphere, and really from all over the world. It was a hemispheric social forum this year. The first five were total, the World Social Forum from all over this year. They decided to break it up into hemispheric social fora. So one was in Venezuela, and another was in Mali. The third was supposed to be in Pakistan, but because of the earthquake, it was postponed, and I think will take place in a couple of months. Mm. So it wasn't the full large-scale thing, and yet it was plenty large. There were well over 100,000 people there in attendance.
And what were some of the topics people focus on?
I think one of the really exciting things is to follow the revolution in Bolivar, the things that are happening with Evo Morales and the real grassroots democracy that is building there. I went to a panel where there were some of the people from the grassroots movement in Bolivia talking about their work, and they're talking about it as grassroots as opposed to the somewhat top-down revolution that's taking place in Venezuela. The Bolivarian Revolution, which, I mean, very much citizen participation at a grassroots level, but there are some sort of structures that are imposed, you know, like the missions in the barrios, which are very good, but they're more of a hierarchical, in a way, kind of top-down form, rather than the real grassroots coming up from the bottom that is happening in Bolivia.
Mm-hmm. And for listeners who may not know, the missions is a social program in Venezuela that tackles issues such as literacy, medical care,
education, health, employment.
And a large part, they have been actually pretty successful, particularly the literacy part.
Very much so, yeah. And the health, you know, what's really amazing is Barrio El Dentro is the health program, and that consists of Cuban doctors who have come in to work with Venezuelan doctors and help set up health clinics in the barrios. And so in every neighborhood in the barrio, it's either there or in process. They have these brick octagonal structures, which are about as big as the room we're in, which is, 10 by 10, 12 by 12. And there's a medical clinic below, and the doctors live upstairs. And they're available 24 hours a day on call for the people in the barrio neighborhoods.
And barrio, different than other countries in Latin America and Venezuela, does not just mean neighborhood. It means slum, for better choice of words. So it's
right, and
poor.
They're everywhere. They're up and down the hills, and there's a kind of a beauty to it in a way. Seeing these buildings just going, following the shape of the hill up and down and around. And actually, compared to barrios that I've seen in places like Nicaragua, they're cleaner and. At least the one I was in. We visited 23 Enero, 23rd January barrio, which is quite a revolutionary barrio. Actually, I think there are 300,000 people living there, and I only saw some neighborhoods of it and had a tour of part of it. And it was really impressive to see and to talk about the things that they're doing in the barrios.
And I've seen them too, and they're quite compared to, like, I know the barrios, the slums of Ankara, for example, that are periodically raided and completely torn apart just to terrorize people and to discourage permanency. Whereas in Caracas, it seems those barrios are permanent, they're serviced, there's the clinics, there's subsidized food places.
Right, and they're pretty much self-policing too, which is good or bad, depending on how you see it, but the police stay away. There are really strong feeling of class difference in Venezuela, and the middle class who you see on the streets typically. They're very suspicious. They caution you. Before I went to Venezuela and read the guidebooks, I would probably wouldn't even go in there if I had really believed everything. Because it's all about how dangerous it is. And really, I'm sure that they're written with middle class people in mind, because I felt very safe in Caracas. Mm-hmm. Unusually, so I thought the people were extremely kind. Traffic was very gentle, you know, for a big city. I mean, you could cross anytime you chose to cross, and people would stop, and they wouldn't be irritated, you know. It felt very safe, and I had a handbag, and I clung to it, but never did I feel threatened. Anytime anyone made change for me, I felt that they counted it out so carefully and made sure that they had it exactly right. Mm-hmm. Never felt that I was being ripped off, you know. And if I'd be riding on the metro and part of my purse would be hanging open, people would be pointing to it. And they're always cautioning us, you know, the middle class people especially are always cautioning us because they think that those other people are so dangerous. And really, this is a big problem, I think, with the revolution, is bringing the factions together. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bolivarian Revolution is just going to, it has to, they have an interesting two-track government going on right now where the middle class are still holding on to some of the power, and the barrio people, the barrio residents, are being brought up to speed with the programs. But it's going to be hard to make that all come together. Mm-hmm. That's the big challenge, I think, of the Bolivarian Revolution.
Mm-hmm. And a huge chunk of the press is in private hands, and is actually in the hands of the opposition.
Yeah,
and I believe fuels some of the information, or so-called information, we get here.
I think, I'm sure.
You know, as little as it is, really.
Yeah, we just don't get good information about the revolution. I picked up some papers, on the street, and just randomly, and found this really good one that's called Las Papeles de Andinga, which the first one that I got gave a very complete, the whole paper was devoted to talking about the World Social Forum and talking about the history of it and the things that went on. So the following week I picked up another copy of it, and this one has, that's my phone.
Okay. You're going to fix that phone in a second? It's got still the Venezuelan rhythm on it, Agamas.
Okay. So this one, there was a march on last Saturday, which is the 4th of February, and it's the anniversary of the day that Hugo Chavez first appeared on the scene. And he appeared on a television program, and the statements that he made were unlike anything anyone had heard before in Venezuela, and that's when he was first noticed, and that's considered a very special day in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So there was a march. I was in Mérida that day with a group of folks from Portland, and but one of the people from Portland who was there did attend the march, or two people, in fact, that I met. Trillium also attended the big march. Hundreds of thousands of people from all over Venezuela. And this picture on the front is a sea of red just going on for blocks and blocks.
And it's a lot of people. And, of course, we didn't hear a word about this march here.
Probably not. What you heard about was George Bush calling, or Rumsfeld calling, Hugo Chavez Hitler.
Right.
Which is so absurd.
And it seems the opposition press in Venezuela and the mainstream press here makes it look like Chavez really does not have any follower, that there is no support for this project, and that if there is a march in support, it's probably a handful of people that are paid or something.
And the interesting thing is there was a march in opposition, and that's where you saw the handful of people that were probably paid.
So this was a huge march.
It was huge, yeah, and it went on all day, and it went on for kilometers.
What were some of the other issues talked about at the World Social Forum?
Well, there was a women's section, and I went to one of those talks, and I'm sorry that my memory is not clear now as to what went on. I did a lot of videotaping. I went down there as media. You know, I'm a member of Code Pink, but my involvement with Code Pink there was quite minimal, and my involvement with media was more intense. I did see Medea Benjamin, though, and Cindy Sheehan hung out with Code Pink, and they did a banner walk, which was I caught on film. So I'm going to be putting together some of my video images and getting them on cable access, and hoping to find other venues to show those. And I'll be happy to do report backs when I have it all together. And also, I'm hoping to be able to split off some of the sound so that we'll have some material for cable.
Mm-hmm. And the situation of women in Venezuela is interesting, to put it in that term, maybe, because it's an intensely sexist society.
Yeah.
But with the constitution in 1999, the Bolivarian constitution, I believe is the only constitution in Latin America that addresses specifically women's rights in some interesting ways. For one thing, they got rid of sexist language. And in Spanish, there's different words for he or she. This constitution consistently uses both mm-hmm. terms. Women in Venezuela are entitled per constitution to receive social security if they were housewives.
Yeah.
And equality is written into that constitution. That, of course, doesn't mean that things change overnight.
Of course they don't. No, these patterns are embedded. But mm-hmm. at least to address them at a constitutional level is really mm-hmm. good. And in the tour that we had of the barrio, there was a married couple that led us on the tour, both of them really bright people who live in the barrio, and the woman spoke beautiful English. Her English was impeccable. So education definitely has benefited them. She's just getting her degree in English, and she seemed quite liberated, and some of the people we talked to who were leaders in the community were women.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about the bank program? There is a particular bank loan program for women.
No, I haven't heard about that.
It's actually the local Central America Solidarity Committee has a video that addresses that program of small loans, credits for women, particularly if they run whatever they want a loan for as a collective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that has been another thing that mm-hmm. has been very supportive of women. So what else were your impressions from Venezuela?
Well, I had hoped to do more video networking than I was able to do, because the reason I couldn't is because I'm a Mac user and all of the video was taking place on PC. However, they had a really great setup. They had Adobe Premiere, and anyone that's up to speed on that, they were asking people to tape things, and then everybody put up 3 minutes a day, so they were doing a 5 o'clock news segment featuring people who are active at the forum. And a fellow videographer from Portland, Jim Rathel, was able to produce a lot of video and put it out for the 5 o'clock news. There's a video TV station there, TV Vive, which is very progressive, and they're getting funding from the state, and they're doing some really interesting stuff that I'm hoping to get on cable access here so that people have more access to that. Mm-hmm. But and hoping to set up some networking relationships with them, and they're networking with people throughout Latin America, and they're really excited about having network in this part of the world too, because we know so little about Latin America, mm-hmm. and they're really at the grassroots and really all about people making video, very similar in some ways to the cable access facilities that we have here. They encourage people to come in and talk about their issues and make their own video.
There also is a ton of community radio stations in Venezuela.
That too, yeah, and Patrick and Trillium and Barbara explored that too, made some contacts mm-hmm. with some of the radio people. I'm a little disappointed that I didn't get to do more video activism than I had planned on, but that basically my limitations were the Mac PC mm-hmm. divide. One of the problems with the conference is that there were not as many simultaneous translators as they were anticipated. I think that the funding got cut for some 40 simultaneous translators. So a lot of the seminars were in Spanish only, and unless your Spanish is really, really fluent, you weren't able to go. So, mm-hmm. And then the forums were held in different places throughout the city of Caracas. The idea was to expose people who came in to the larger city of Caracas, and also to expose people in Caracas to people from other parts of the world. And I think it was successful in that, but it also made it very hard to get from one place to another, from one event to another. There were so many. I mean, you look at the schedule in here, it's just every day you're offering.
The whole newspaper.
It's a thick newspaper, and that's just for the first 3 days of the conference. Mm. So there were sessions going back to back all the time. There were probably 100 options to choose from at any given time. But the problem would be then you have a three-hour session in one part of Caracas, and then you have to get to a three-hour session in another part of Caracas. Mm-hmm. So it was well planned to the extent that it was, but the negotiations, the logistics of moving around were just a little more difficult than they should have been, I think.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Atley, who in fact just returned yesterday from Venezuela and who participated in the World Social Forum, who filmed a lot of it, and hopefully I will definitely announce on this program when some of these things air on cable access, and hopefully we can also transcribe some of it for cable programs. Seems to me there is kind of has developed like a sister city relationship between Portland and different parts of Venezuela, maybe. And a lot of people are going, a lot of people are staying longer. Like, I know several people myself mm-hmm. who are still there. So there is a lot of potential, I believe, for mutual exchange of ideas and material and radio and TV programs that I find very exciting.
Yeah, no, truly, I was working in a community project, community radio project, and people were there from the Prometheus Project. She went down there working with them, and they're setting up radio towers in different parts of Venezuela. So, yeah, definitely with the idea that there would be networking, and Patrick, of course, is working on creating networks. So, yeah, I think we're going to be hearing more about the Bolivarian Revolution from within in the future, and that's pretty exciting.
Yeah. And I wonder how long it's going to last when this administration is going to come up with a travel ban to Venezuela a la Cuba, which you also are involved in with the Cuba Solidarity.
Yeah, I've been involved in Cuba Solidarity for several years, and it is interesting some of the parallels that are going on.
Mm-hmm. So hopefully that won't happen, or we won't let it happen, but that's...
Yeah, and I think, yeah, I hope that people who listen will be alert to these changes, because definitely the government is starting to be making big noises about clamping down on things, and mm-hmm. they're going to start treating it like Cuba.
And their rhetoric, I find so interesting, it's always the same rhetoric. Like, they can't think of anything new. So it's always the same pattern.
And they always go back, they resort to the Hitler comparisons, which if we use them for Bush, it's like, how dare you?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So anything else you want to report about your stay in Venezuela? Oh. You were there like 3 weeks, I believe?
I was there for 3 weeks, yeah. And,
you also went to places outside of the big city.
Yeah, and it's a really vast and beautiful country, and I saw just little parts of it. We went to Merida, which is in the Andes, and hiked around and visited some small villages close to there. Took the teleférico, the tourist at the highest and the longest gondola to the top of the Andes, where there are statues of Simón Bolívar and the Virgin Mary. You kind of wonder who's hauling these statues up there. But Simón Bolívar is everywhere. Every city in Venezuela has a Bolívar Plaza. You know, Simón Bolívar, the liberator of South America, was born in Venezuela, and so he is very much revered there. The currency is in Bolívars, which is about, 25,000 to a dollar or something. The exchange rate is not... Anyway, you're dealing in thousands all the time, so, which is interesting, thousands of bolivars. But interesting, his portrait is different on three different bills. It sort of looks like a different person. And this goes back to a time before photography was really current. And so we're not really sure what Simón Bolívar looks like.
All in the eye of the beholder. Huh?
Yeah, but there's Bolívar Street, Bolívar Plaza.
Mm-hmm. And I was there in December, and I found ethnic relations interesting. For one thing, I could hardly ever tell who was what, because Venezuelan society seems very mixed
up.
It's
very mixed.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't seem to be a huge issue. I'm sure there is racism, but compared to here, it just didn't. For example, ethnic diversity was reflected in advertisement. It was even reflected in the nativity scenes for Christmas.
Oh, the nativity scenes, and you know what? Those nativity scenes are still up. Christmas goes on forever.
Like, I've never seen a black nativity scene in the States.
Oh, I didn't see that.
And it was actually in the airport. There was several places I saw those in Venezuela.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and actually I did some interviews with people who are of Afro-Venezuelan ethnicity, and I have to say that I don't know yet what they said, because we haven't gone through the transcription yet, but they were very animated, and I know that they're good interviews, and I can't wait to find out what they talked about. But I get the impression that it's definitely much more of a blend, and that there's not the racial kind of hierarchy that we have here.
And also something that was surprising to me, a fairly strong Arab influence. You know, like, I went to the mosque in downtown Caracas. It was interesting, because I didn't really necessarily expect that. pretty diverse society, divided badly among class lines.
So that's the biggest division, is the class line. And true, I think that you find that in the middle class is whiter.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could say racist to that extent, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, has probably a lot to do with historical realities.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to edit the videos and stuff, and people are continuing to come back, and probably we have more people on the radio.
Yes, I'm sure.
I would encourage anybody to go. I know there is a trip organized from Portland Community College and Portland State University in summer, organized by John Olmsted, who is still there.
I'm not sure how that's going to materialize.
Okay.
I think he's having some second thoughts, so stay tuned about that.
Okay.
And I believe that Global Exchange has a women's group going down there in the near future, Global Exchange and Code Pink, and I don't have details on that.
Okay.
But I think that's happening in the near future, so you want to check codepink.org, codepinkalert.org, and Global Exchange to find out more information about that, because I think that would be really interesting.
And I, from my experience, would definitely second what you said, that I never felt threatened in downtown Caracas, even at night. We rode the metro all the time. So it's definitely not as crazy as people make it sound.
No, interestingly, I felt a little bit more anxious walking in the streets in Mérida, which is a much smaller city. Because I think that the reason that the drivers are so courteous in Caracas is that they're so used to inching along, that they're so used to bottlenecks and traffic stops, that they figure, so what if I let a pedestrian pass, you know, I'll get there just as soon as I would have otherwise. Whereas in the smaller towns, you get the feeling that people are in a hurry to get somewhere and they're impatient with someone trying to walk across the street. So I felt a little more threatened by the traffic in the smaller towns.
So this was Elizabeth Atlee, who went through great sacrifice to get here to talk to us about her trip to Venezuela. If you're interested in an organized tour, check out the website for Global Exchange. Also, Code Pink was very visible at the World Social Forum with Media Benjamin and Cindy Sheehan.
Jody Evans.
Uh-huh. They also are producing an interesting, if you go to their website, an interesting women's call for peace in a multitude of languages, and it's, I believe, co-drafted by U.S. women and women from Iraq. And the demands are the withdrawal of all foreign troops from Iraq, to incorporate women into any negotiations, to get rid of all foreign bases in Iraq, to have Iraq control its own oil resources. It goes on with a longer list of interesting demands. And it's probably one of the few reasonable things I've seen in that whole question. I also want to announce an event tonight. If you hurry very fast, you can go to a Day Laborers Popular Theater project that will present tonight at 7, from 7 to 9 p.m. at St. Francis Dining Hall. And the topic is the Sensenbrenner Bill. If you haven't heard about that, it's probably the most vicious anti-immigrant piece of legislature that's on the table now, and it already passed its first hurdle. So if you want to know more about that, go to the Day Laborers Popular Theater Project tonight. It's starting at 7, St. Francis Dining Hall at 330 Southeast 11th. There also will be an Immigrant Rights March on March 4th, I believe, but we will keep you updated about that. Thank you for listening tonight. This was Bread and Roses, Women's News and Public Affairs on KBOO 90.7 FM. Have a good evening.
is the KBU Community Calendar for Friday, February 10th. There is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that invites American audience to step across the royal threshold and witness firsthand artistic treasures that until now have lay hidden behind castle doors. This international exhibit is devoted to the great artistic wealth of the German House of Hesse that was constructed towards the end of the last century by the Empress Frederick of Germany. This is a rare opportunity to view such beautiful antiquities of historical significance and artistic excellence, which was brought about by continual collaborative efforts and devotion between the museum and the Hesse family. For more info, call 503-226-2811. Tickets are $15 adults, 13 seniors, PCC Sylvania's 6th annual production of the Vagina Monologues, sponsored by the Women's Resource Center. Showtimes are 8 p.m. on February 10th. And 11th, and at 2 p.m. on February 12th. Doors open 1 hour before the show. Tickets are $15 for general admission, $12 for students, and $10 for groups of 10 or more. They can be purchased at the PCC's Women's Resource Center and other books and through Ticketmaster. The goal of the Vagina Monologue is to raise awareness to stop violence against women and girls and raise funds for our beneficiaries. The Sexual Minority Youth Resource Center, the PCC Illumination Project. There will be a silent auction before the shows on Friday and Saturday to benefit SMRC, with performances in the lobby by local musicians Allie Haynes and M. Brownlow of the Swallows. Contact Jessica Almaroth or Jazz McGinnis at 503-977-8101. The Portland Community College is located at 12000 Southwest 49th at the Sylvania campus. One can see a new documentary called Broken Limbs, placed in Wenatchee, Washington, the Apple Capital of the World. This pastoral valley is in the heart of the Northwest. It has prospered for nearly a century and has home to the famed Washington apple. Apple orchardists by thousands are going out of business and thousands more await the dreaded letter from the bank. After his own father received such a letter, filmmaker Guy Evans sets out on a journey to find out what went wrong here in this natural Garden of Eden. Over the course of the filming, Evan witnesses small farmers struggling to compete. The future looks grim for the Apple Capital until Evans happens upon an entirely new breed of farmers, practitioners of a new model called sustainable agriculture. Broken Limbs explores these hopeful stirrings within agriculture, outlining ways in which any individual can play a role in saving America's farms. Sponsored by the UU Community for Earth, there will be a $5 suggested donation. This show is showing at the First Unitarian Church on 1011 Southwest 12th. For more info, call Barbara Ford at 503-282-0740 or visit the web at www.firstunitarianportland.org. Portland's own Rose Hibear is an author, producer, and project manager of the Wisdom of the Elders and many Native American oral history projects and events. She will speak about her traditional heritage as Dehetandin and of the Caribou people, one of the 7 Matrino nations still subsisting today in the subarctic interior of Alaska. She may also share stories from her nearly completed biography of the late medicine man, Martin Hibear. Donations are $10 to $20. They are requested to support the elders, and no one will be turned away for lack of funds. This event is at the PSU Native American Student and Community Center on Southwest Broadway and Jackson. For more info, call 503-452-4483 or visit the web earthandspirit.org. That was Community Calendar. You're listening to KBOO, Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.